This interview is being recorded for the Australian Garden History Society. It's an interview with Mr. Victor Crittenden, OAM, former president of the ACT, Monaro and Riverina branch, based in Canberra. The interview is being recorded in Mr. Crittenden's home in Canberra on Wednesday the 20th of October 2010. The interviewer is Rosalind Burge. So Victor, thank you for your time this morning for the Society's Oral History Project. If we could just start with some brief biographical details. If you could give me your full name and your date of birth.
My full name is Victor Crittenden, only one Christian name, and I was born on the 27th of April 1925 in Hamilton, a suburb of Newcastle.
Were your parents living there at the time?
Yes, my parents were living there at the time. They came from Maitland, but my father was working in Newcastle, and when they married, they moved from Maitland to to Newcastle, and that's where my older brother was born, and I was born 2 years later after him. Actually, he died at the age of five when we were still living in Newcastle. He died of meningitis, actually. My mother, I don't think, ever really recovered from that. He was, of course, I shouldn't say it, but he was the favourite son. Well, I was only a two-year-old when he died, actually. But he was named after my uncle, my father's brother, who was killed in the First World War. My father was injured seriously in the First World War. He was paralysed from the waist down for 2 years after he was buried alive in France. the uncle that was killed in the Battle of Gaza, or the Battle of Bathsheba, actually. And he was he's buried in Gaza at the moment. Well, still there. I mean, it's in the war cemetery there. So he was my father's, I suppose, almost a father figure for my father. He was somewhat older than my father, and his father, my grandfather, was not home very often. He was a bullock driver. And so he was not home very much, and so the older brother took over the father sort of role. And so when my brother was born, he was named after the father the brother that was killed in the Middle East. I always say he was fighting with Lawrence of Arabia.
You're right about the impact of that, of the death of a child on the family, and how that ricochets through a family.
Yes, well, my mother was very ill afterwards for quite some time, and it wasn't until 6 years later that she had another child, a daughter, and that was my sister, actually. So we grew up as two children in the family, that was all. And we were very close. We used to play together and spend a lot of time with each other, actually. And so she, even when she married, we still remained very close. And I used to spend every Christmas with her and her husband and her children. They lived in Bathurst. And as children, we both had our own gardens in every house we moved to.
Why did you move so often?
It was a matter of not having large sums of money. It was mainly during the Depression, and my father lost his job in Newcastle in the Depression, and lost all his money. He'd invested his money in a shirt factory in Newcastle. They had difficulty paying back the loan to the bank, so the bank took over the business. Didn't, no compensations at all. Didn't get a thing, actually. And so we lived for a while on the block of land, well, the block of land he'd bought, my father had bought to build a house, was sold so that we had some money to live on. And my mother always complained that she had to sell her piano so that they could have food to eat, so that we could eat. And finally he got a job up in the country, and we moved up to Quirindi, which is up in the Northern Tablelands, up south of Tamworth, actually.
What was he doing there?
He was a shopkeeper. He used to, well, he worked in a shop, actually, and was in charge of, usually in charge of a menswear department. That was what he did in Newcastle. And when he went to Quirindi, he took over the menswear department in the department store in Quirindi. And there he did a very good job on it, and we lived there then for 3 years. I went to school. I was just over six years old when I went to when we went to Queensland. When we went to Quirindi, and then I started school in Quirindi and spent 3 years there. and then mother started a garden. She was a keen gardener, and I had a garden also in Quirindi, and that was where I first learned how to grow things from cuttings.
What sort of things did you grow?
Mother always loved roses, and she had along the front fence of the house a lot of polyanthus roses. And when they were all pruned, I pinched off with some of the prunings and put them in my garden, and they all grew.
Do you still grow roses today?
I still have some roses, yes, but they're mostly shrub roses, the old-fashioned roses, actually, which I had read about and liked the stories about the early roses. So my roses are basically, they all need, very badly need attention at the moment. But being shrub roses, they don't have to be pruned in quite the same way. So I still have some roses, actually.
When we spoke on the telephone, Victor, you mentioned too that you'd bought bulbs.
Oh, yes. That was when we were living in Ashbury. We did finally, when we settled in Sydney, we did finally bought a house in Sydney, in Ashbury, which is just it's halfway between Ashfield and Canterbury. And we always claimed that's why it was called Ashbury. They took the ash from Ashfield and the berry from Canterbury, called it Ashbury. It was a suburb that was built in the late 1920s, so it was a bungalow suburb, actually. And we bought a house there. Well, we lived there in a rented house for a year or two, and then bought a house in Ashbury. That was just before the Second World War, actually. And mother was then able to enjoy herself buying all sorts of roses and putting them all over the garden, actually.
Was there a garden in the house when you went there?
A sort of garden, but it wasn't very much, actually. There was a buffalo lawn in the front and a couple of little garden beds, and nothing much in the back except some fruit trees, mainly peach trees and the nectarine tree, actually. Oh, and a large what sort of tree was it? Oh, I can't think what it was, actually. But we cut that one down. But there was also a Queensland wattle tree, which was a lovely tree in the back garden. It's the only one I've ever seen, actually. So that was all there was really in the house, in the garden at the time, actually. But we established a large vegetable garden in the back, which was run by Mother during the war, of course. Father was away in the army, and it was a corner block, and I had the job of mowing the grass.
You say that with a note of disdain.
Yes, I didn't enjoy pushing a mower around the footpath area of the garden. It was mainly paspalum.
And you went to Homebush Boys from there.
Yes, yes. Well, I've. When we moved to Sydney, we stayed with my aunt, who lived in Hurlston Park. Don't know if you know where Hurlston Park is, but it's...
I know where it is.
Near Summer Hill, actually, yes. She lived in Hurlston Park, and we stayed with her when we first went to Sydney. His father didn't have a job at that time, and her daughter... Bobby, a little girl, she was always called Bobby, used to go to Canterbury Girls' School. And so when we were staying with Aunt Sybil, I was taken off to the same school. It was two schools, actually, a girls' school and a boys' school side by side at Canterbury. And so I was enrolled in the boys' school in Canterbury. And that's where I continued to go to school. Even when we moved to Summer Hill, I used to walk, it was about a mile and a half actually, to school each morning. And so I stayed at Canterbury, and then when we moved from Summer Hill to Ashbury, which is the other side of Hurlston Park, near Canterbury, I still went to Canterbury Boys School, primary school in the 1930s. and when I completed my schooling there, I was not considered good enough to go to Canterbury High School. Or Fort Street High School, which was a specialist school in those days, still is, I think. And because I'd had a rather broken primary school, I hadn't done particularly well in my final year at Canterbury Boys School, so they sent me off to Homebush. Which was quite a trip. Every day I had to walk up to the bus, which I suppose was only about a quarter of a mile. And then I caught the bus to Ashfield, and then I caught the train from Ashfield to Homebush, and walked from Homebush station another half a mile or more up to the school. So that was what I did each day, actually. I did fairly well at Homebush, actually, and finally sat for the intermediate certificate, got a few A's, and a few A's and a few B's, and then that was sufficient to take me then to Canterbury. They considered I was good enough then, of course, to go to Canterbury to go on and do the leaving certificate, as it was called in those days. But I didn't finish, actually. I left school after fourth year and went to work, as my father was having problems with his war injuries, and I decided that it was up to me to do something. So I went to work in a warehouse in Sydney, a good old warehouse called Sargood Gardeners. They still exist, actually, but not. They had a big warehouse in York Street, just next door to what is now a famous hotel, actually.
Not the Grace?
Yeah, yes, yes.
I think the name may still even be there on the building. Is it on the building?
Oh, Sargood Gardeners. Yes, I think it is, actually.
I've seen the name.
It was a substantial brick and stone building, actually.
There were some fine buildings along York Street.
Yes.
Fine warehouse buildings.
There were a lot of warehouses along there, actually, yes. So I worked there in the soft good furnishings area, actually, which I enjoyed doing.
For someone who may listen to this in 100 years' time, what are those items?
Mainly curtains, carpets, and blinds. They're soft good. It was a soft good warehouse, actually, and it dealt mainly in men's and women's clothing and soft furnishings. Didn't have any hard furnishings. Didn't have any tables or beds or any of that sort of thing. But all the soft furnishings that you have for a house, actually.
When could I ask you, Victor, that's a big choice to make, to leave school and to take on the responsibilities for bringing money into your family. Was that your ambition?
No. My ambition was to go to university, actually. And I had to put that on hold. I thought I would go and do some night courses at the Technical College in Sydney, but I didn't get round to doing that.
What area were you looking or thinking of going into?
I wanted to be an architect, actually. I'd built houses, model houses and mud houses in the garden ever since I can remember, actually.
Did you build them with gardens?
Oh, they always had a garden, yes. I had a whole village of them at one stage.
Did you?
With gardens and roads and a church and all model, mostly out of clay, actually. And I would always arrange a garden around the house and the houses and what have you. Usually with a fountain in the garden. I built a palace, actually. A clay palace, actually. And it had a garden with a fountain in the... Always had a fountain, actually.
Is that because you lived in a house with a fountain?
No. Never had a fountain in the house. I had a childhood image of a palace, and an image of a palace always had fountains. I think it must have been from Versailles or something like that. And then it was interior, it always had chandeliers.
Heavens, that's a very detailed palace.
Yes, well, and so ever afterwards, every house I've owned has had a chandelier in it.
Oh, that's a lovely story. In fact, that reminds me, I'd like to go back. Is it always the same chandelier?
No. I've usually left the chandelier in the house or the apartment when I sold it, actually, with the rather romantic idea that the chandelier belongs to the house, not to me.
Again, when we spoke on the telephone, you spoke about these bulbs that we're...
The bulbs, yes. Let's get back to the bulbs.
Well, I'm interested because there's that same theme that you spoke of, always having bulbs with each house you've gone to.
Yes, well, as a child, this was when I was working in Saga Gardeners, actually. I used to go off at lunchtime, usually to the bookshops. But sometimes I would call into Selfridges, which was it was like the American 5 and 10 cent stores. You know, it was the cheap store, actually, and it used to sell all kinds of things. I think you would compare it perhaps to the reject shops these days, actually.
Was this in York Street as well?
No, they were opposite each other in Pitt Street, close to where the famous arcade is, the Royal Arcade in goes from George to Pitt. It's still there, actually.
The Strand.
No, it's the Strand. That's right. Yes, there were a number of arcades, but in what is now the Pitt Street Mall, Selfridges was on one side of the road, and Coles was on the other side of the road.
Yes, I know where you are.
And I would sometimes call in there to buy something or to look for something. And they always had a plant section. You could buy your plants in little bundles. And they had bulbs. They used to have roses at the appropriate time, you know, all wrapped up in a piece of cloth around the root. And I bought a rose there, actually. It was a white rose, Karl Froh Duschke, I think it's called, for the centrepiece in my little garden. I liked white roses, but my mother wouldn't have white flowers in the garden.
There was a general feeling that white flowers were sometimes funereal.
Yes, they reminded her of the grave of her favourite son. I shouldn't use the word favourite because it gives a wrong impression that I wasn't the favourite son, sort of thing. she wouldn't have any white flowers in the garden, actually. Yes. Particularly, she disliked jonquils.
Oh, they're lovely fragrance.
Yes, they used to grow them in the cemetery because, you know, you plant the and they would come up each year, so you would have these on the grave in the cemetery. So she wouldn't have them in the garden at all, actually.
So how did she feel about you bringing home a white rose?
She didn't worry about that, actually. She didn't impose her likes and dislikes on us. One of the things, she wouldn't drink tea. That was another one of her peculiarities, you might say. I don't know the reason for it, but there must have been some reason in her childhood. Perhaps it made her sick on some occasion, so she wouldn't have tea. She always had coffee. That was a time when coffee was an unusual drink in Australia. She always had coffee and Father always had tea.
Of course, this question has nothing to do with the Garden History Society, but I'm curious, what sort of coffee? Did she drink that chicory?
Yes, she did.
In the bottle, yes. That's right. I think very popular at a time.
Coffee and chicory, yes.
So again, returning to the
bulbs. Yes, the bulbs I bought at Selfridges, and they were supposedly daffodils, and I planted them in my garden, and they came up and flowered, but they were small, and they weren't a single flower on them. So technically they weren't really daffodils, they're fritillias or something. Actually, I did find out the name once. But no, they came up and flourished, and each year I would plant a few more around the place, and so they remained. And during the war, Mother took over, of course. She took over my area of garden when I was not there. I was in the army, and she planted some of them in the front garden. And they flourished in the front garden. And every spring, the front garden would be a mass of these yellow, what I still call daffodils. And so when I established when I bought a house in Armidale, this is taking me on quite a few years, I took some of the bulbs from the garden in Sydney, where Mother was still living, and planted them in my garden in Armidale. And then when I moved from Armidale to Canterbury, to Canberra, I took some of the bulbs with me, and I planted them in the first house I rented in Canberra. And when I moved from there and finally moved to this house, I brought some of them with me. So they've been my my daffodil bulbs from childhood. Mm. And one of the reasons, of course, I liked daffodils was because at school we were taught two famous poems about daffodils. I wandered lonely as a crowd. And the other was, "Fair daffodils, we weep to see thee haste away so soon," which were poems that we had to learn. And I always thought I liked those because they associated me with my garden and what have you. And so my daffodils have continued to find, as I said, I think I said to you the other night, I thought I'd lost them during the drought because they just disappeared, but this year they shot up and two of them flowered, so I've got my heritage daffodils back.
That's lovely.
Yes, we did get back to the daffodils finally.
I don't want to spend too long because the Garden History Society will think I've come here and we've never got to this society yet. But I am curious to see your leap from Sargoods to Armidale. Could you just tell me very briefly about that?
Yes, well, when I turned 18 in the Sargood Gardeners, I went into the army and spent the next 4 years in the army. No garden experiences in the army. Except there was in St. Ives, you know St. Ives in Sydney, I was for a time in a holding, army holding station in St. Ives.
Was that at the showground?
It was at the showground, but the commander of that particular had his headquarters in another part of St. Ives, where he owned a very large block of land. And so the army was paying him rent to have his headquarters in this large block of land, and he used the men, his soldiers, to develop his garden.
Were you one of those soldiers?
I did actually do some help in the garden in his place. I think after the war he built a large house on the block of land and he had his garden already beautifully established. I don't know which man he was, so I can't give you his name. But that was my connection, only connection with gardens during my time in the army.
So what happened after the war?
After the war, I came out and went to university. Did get there, actually, finally. Actually, I hadn't intended to. When I was in the army, I started to do some courses by correspondence. The army had an army education system, and I started to do some courses to get my entrance to, get my high school certificate in effect, actually. But I thought I would go on and become a school teacher. I'd go to teachers' college and get a scholarship and become a teacher. I gave up the idea of, I'd given up the idea of becoming an architect. I said I was too old to start.
We don't let that bother you subsequently.
It would take me another 5 or 6 years to get to, and I'd be too old then. So I thought I'd be a school teacher. So at the end of the war, they had a whole series of tests for young men coming out of the army to see what they might be suitable to go on and do. And I took all these tests. And then I was interviewed, and I said that I had planned to go to teachers' college and become a school teacher, primary school teacher. And the fellow, a young man, said to me, why don't you go to university and then become a high school teacher? And I said, I don't think I'm good enough. Being a shy, retiring type person I was. And he said, yes, and there's no reason why you couldn't go to university. Your level is well above the average university student. My ego took a jump. And so I said, okay, I'll go to university then. So they put me down said they would give me a scholarship to go to university. This was the for returned servicemen were given this option of a scholarship to study for their new career. And so I came out of the army about the middle of the year, 1946, I think it was, and I said, I've got to get a university entrance. And I said, I'll have to sit for the high school certificate. And they said, you can go and study, sort of go back to school, I suppose. And do that next year. That would have been 1947. So I said, okay. When I went home, I decided that I had another friend who was in exactly the same position, and he lived not very far from me. And we both talked about this, and we said, I think we should try the higher school certificate ourselves and see how we go. It'll be good practice anyhow, if we're going to have to do it again next year. And so we studied by ourselves for the high school certificate, put in our enrolment as private students to go to the high school certificate. And we sat for the examinations, and we both failed in the same subject, one subject. We passed in everything else, but we failed in geography. Both of us, the same subject. And then they said, oh, well, we can allow you to keep your subjects for the higher school certificate that you've passed, but you can then sit for the one you failed in at the university. The university used to run special special examinations,
yes,
for entrance. And so we both sort of went and sat for the geography in the university courses. I passed.
Were you working throughout this time?
No, I wasn't actually. This was when we got out of the army. I had still, I had my deferred pay and my pay continued for some time after I got out, until we got ourselves organised. But I then got my scholarship after I'd got my university. However, my friend, he failed in geography.
Oh dear.
So what did he do? He went and to the State Library of New South Wales to their library course, and he became a librarian. And then he studied at university, night university, and finally got his degree that way. So I then went through university and got my degree, and then I went to teach. I still went teaching, but I didn't go into the public school. I went to a private school. I went down to Victoria to Geelong College, which is a Presbyterian private school in Ballarat, spent a year there teaching. And then I moved from there down to Geelong College, which is also Presbyterian. I'm not a Presbyterian, actually. I'm Church of England. But it was Presbyterian school who accepted me as a teacher down there. I didn't have any teaching qualifications, but they had a system there where you could take your examinations for a teaching certificate while you were teaching, an intern sort of way of learning. And so I did get my teaching certificate from Victoria. But at the time I was in Geelong, I had a friend down there who was also a teacher in Geelong. And one day, We were great friends. He was a marvellous person, actually. He taught me an enormous amount of things about living. And
how do you mean?
Well, he was the person who pushed me into studying things. When I was in Geelong, he said, oh, you don't want to just sit back on that degree you got in Sydney, that's fine, but you should do something else, you know. And so he persuaded me to enrol in a course from London University, London, England, and London University used to run external courses for the colonies. And so I enrolled in a course to study to be, it was a course in economics. It was a Bachelor of Science in Economics from the University of London. he was doing a course himself in that area, a bit further on than me, and he then persuaded me to do that. So I was, well, I was quite happy to do it, and so I said, okay. And so I enrolled to do that, and I sat for the first year's examinations and failed. At least you had 8 subjects. You were studying by yourself. You didn't have, because I'd already done my high school certificate by myself, so I was quite able to, and I had John, my friend, to help in the study, but I failed in one subject.
Rather like your geography.
Statistics. Oh. That's a very difficult subject to teach yourself, actually. So I failed in that, and so I said, oh well, I'll repeat the year. And you couldn't carry anything over. You had to repeat the whole lot all over again.
No.
That was part of their rules in the University of London.
So this was in your spare time while you're teaching in
July?
That's
right, that was in my spare time.
And this gentleman, who was such a great friend to encourage you in your extracurricular studies, has he seen all the... do you still keep in touch with him? Has he seen the work that you've done?
Oh yeah, he's now dead actually. We're coming to John. I can still remember we were in Geelong, and we were sitting on the headland, looking out over Corio Bay, which is the bay in which Geelong is situated, Port Phillip area. And he said, oh, I've been given a scholarship. And I said, oh, that's marvellous. Where and how? He said, it's a scholarship to do a PhD in the University of Toronto in Canada. His father had connections in Canada. His father was a doctor who had studied in Canada. So that was the reason, I suppose, why he got a scholarship at the University of Toronto. He apparently applied for it. And I said, oh, that's marvellous. Oh, what am I going to do without you to encourage me on? He said, oh, why don't you come to Canada?
Oh.
And I sat there for a few moments and said, I'd at that stage been toying with the idea of studying to be a librarian, actually, from my other fellow friend in Sydney, who told me all about being a librarian. And so I thought about doing, and I told John about this, and he said, well, there's a very good library school, the University of Toronto. It's a university library school. There isn't a university library school or course in Australia. So he said, why don't you come to Canada and you can do a library course there? And I said, oh, that's a good idea. Yes, okay, I'll come to Canada. Just on no sort of ums and ahs. I just said, oh, yes, okay, I'll come to Canada. So we then set about organising our trip to Canada.
And how long did you live there?
So I was there for 4 years.
It's very interesting. Sometimes life's biggest decisions turn on sixpence, as they say.
Yes, yes. Well, anyhow, I did get to Canada. I did study at the University of Toronto and became a Bachelor of Library Science, which was the library degree. And then got a job for 2 years in the University of Toronto Library. I'm sorry, I'm getting us off gardens.
Well, I think it would be good to return to the gardens.
But I came back from Canada to Armidale at the University of New England. So that's how I filled in that particular period. Gardens.
Just before we come to gardens, just one last question about education, it's clearly been a pursuit and a lifelong journey for you. Is that something your parents instilled in you, or would you say that it was more encouraged by your friend and colleague John?
No, it was my father, actually, who used to always say you should go to university. He never went to university, never went to high school even, actually. But he always said he wanted me to be an engineer. I think he had a childhood ambition to have been an engineer, a civil engineer, building bridges and, you know, roads and things like that. But he never did achieve that. But he always said, oh, you should be an engineer. That's a good job too. That'll get you on in the world, sort of thing. He said, well, you should go to university. And so sometimes when we drove into Sydney in the bus from Ashbury, we would drive past the university and he'd say, there's the university, that's where you should go. So I suppose I was indoctrinated with the idea of going to university from childhood, actually.
Did your mother influence you as well?
My mother was, you know, she was also enthusiastic. She always said she regretted that she could never go to high school when she was a girl, because in those days when she was a girl you had to pay to go to high school. High schools were not free like primary schools.
And that wasn't something her parents could afford.
And her parents, well, she was a family of 9 children, actually. And of course boys were the ones that had to be educated. One of my mother's brothers, or he's actually a half-brother, he did become an engineer. He was educated and become an engineer. And eventually became an engineer in a mining company in China. And I've still got some postcards from China from that particular uncle. And a couple of little Chinese paintings that he'd sent home to his mother, my grandmother. And so he became an engineer, so that was one engineer in the family. And the other, my mother's favourite brother, she went to work in the shop in Maitland. They lived in Maitland. She went to pay for her favourite brother to go through the technical college to become a draftsman. And he eventually became a draftsman at the Australian Gaslight Company in Cabarita. And so it was my mother who provided the money for him to be able to go to there. So she was very keen on educating for a future job, not going off and working. So Saga Gardeners was just a stopgap sort of job for me, actually, because I knew I would be going into the army in a year or so's time. So that's filled in the gap, I think.
most tidily. So shall we revert to the Garden History Society?
Yes, please. Garden History Society.
I'm curious what you knew about the society before it began.
Well, I joined the English Garden History Society. I came across that in a library at some stage. I came across their publication, actually. I said, oh, I'm interested in all that. So I wrote off to them in London. And asked about the society and what have you, and I joined the English Society.
Do you remember when that was?
No.
In the 70s?
must have been in the 70s, actually, yes.
So what prompted you then to join that organisation?
Well, I've always been interested in houses, as I've said, and gardens. And in Armidale, I bought an old house and restored it. And then I said, it was an 1880s house, lovely little house with a two attic. I've always wanted a house with attics.
I won't dare ask you why.
Oh, it's just a childhood dream, actually, I guess. And that's just the little house I bought. The first thing I bought for it, of course, was a chandelier. And it desperately needed a lot of work on restoration, so I set to and restored the house. And at the same time, it was a house on a double block. And it had the remnants of a garden there and a number of plum trees. And so I said, oh, well, if I'm restoring the house, I've got to restore the garden too. So I set to and restored the garden.
Did you join garden clubs or local groups?
No, I didn't join the garden club or any local groups. No, I just set about doing the restoration and and reorganising it the way I thought it should be done, from studying gardening books.
So you were studying gardening books at that time?
Oh yes, I started my garden book collection when I was in Armidale, and the first gardening history type book I bought was Mrs. Rolf Boldrewood's book on the garden in Australia. She wrote her book in the 1890s. And this was a little book I bought when I was in Armidale. I had started buying old gardening books. I was being a mad keen librarian and gardener, it was obvious that I would buy old gardening books. So I started my collection of gardening books at that particular stage, actually. And so that was the reason for my interest in garden history and the Garden History Society in England. It was a sort of crossover between the two sorts of things.
So you began your book collection in the 60s, say?
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Would you purchase them from overseas or buy them locally?
No, they were Australian gardening. Well, I bought both, actually. I bought a lot of gardening books about Australian gardening books, but I also bought a lot of gardening books about mainly gardeners rather than gardens. I mean, Gertrude Jenkel and all of those. I bought those, some of which I bought overseas. One set of Marion Cran. I don't know if you know Marion Cran. She was an English garden writer, wrote a series of books about buying gardens or restoring gardens and what have you. In the 1920s or 1910s and 1920s, and I bought that in Melbourne at what was the name of the famous little bookshop in Melbourne that did all sorts of, I can't think offhand. And I bought a set of her books in Melbourne, and then I bought various other books in secondhand shops in Sydney. I bought a copy of the first Australian gardening book.
What was your feeling when you purchased that?
Well, I knew about it. It was published in Sydney in 1836. Thomas Shepherd's book called The Horticulture of New South Wales. And it was the first book about, it was about vegetables, of course, about gardening. It was the first gardening book published in Australia, and I'd looked around for that for ages, and it never appeared. I think there was a copy in the Mitchell Library. That was the only one, sort of thing. And I was in the little bookshop below the Royal Australian Historical Society's building, run by Margaret Woodhouse. And I was talking to Margaret Woodhouse about books. I often popped in there, walking down from the Mitchell Library, where I was always doing some research of some sort. And I was talking to her and said, "Oh, I've been trying for years to find this gardening book by Thomas Shepherd called The Horticulture of New South Wales." She said, "Oh, I've got a copy." She said, "It's not in very good condition. You can have it. It's not very expensive." Oh! So it was in, I mean, the interior was in good condition. The cover was a mess. And so I bought it from her, for only a few, not very much at all, actually. I can't even remember what the price was, but it was just a very small price, actually. So I bought that, and so I had the first gardening book. Oh. Not only that, but I then bought the second one, the second gardening book, which is also by Thomas Shepherd, and it was called, of all things, Landscape Gardening in Australia. And it was published in 1836 in Sydney.
What was your response when you purchased those two books?
A great excitement, actually. I think the one I got from the second gardening book was perhaps slightly greater than the second one, the landscape gardening one, which I bought or had bought for me in an auction in Tasmania. A famous book collector in Tasmania had a collection which was sold by auction, and I knew that this book was part of the, from the catalogue, I knew this book was on sale. And I said, I can't go to Tasmania to go to the auction. So I rang up a bookseller in Melbourne that I knew slightly. And I said, "Are you going to the auction in Tasmania?" He was a second-hand bookseller. And he said, "Oh, yes, I am." And I said, "Will you bid for me for a book in the auction?" He said, "Oh, yes, yes, yes." And then he said, "How much do I bid for? What's your top price?" And I said, "No, I haven't got one. I want it no matter what the price is." So I was all in needle and, you know, sort of couldn't settle. And he finally rang me up and said, yes, he'd bought it for me. I was just so excited. I didn't ask the price. Oh, I did finally get round to saying, yes, how much am I up for? And he said, "Oh, it was $500 and something. I said, Oh, all right, okay, that's fine." wasn't until I got the book that I found out the original owner of it. It was the first gardening book, second gardening book, Landscape Gardening in Australia. It was owned by the famous painter. Now, don't ask me.
Victor, we can always come back to fill in the momentary blanks.
Yes, well, it's the famous painter who painted a painting of his garden in Tasmania.
Oh, not Glover.
Glover, that's right. Yes, Glover. And his signature is in the front of the book. And the painting, of course, of his garden is in the Art Gallery of South Australia.
What a thrill.
So here I received this marvellous book, and it was beautifully bound, and it's a delightful book. I think it's the treasure of Australian gardening books, actually. So anyhow, I still own it.
How wonderful.
And I still don't know what I'm going to do with it. I think I'll give it to the National Library, actually. I should go to the State Library of Tasmania, but I'm not very happy with the State Library of Tasmania because they didn't reply to my letter when I offered them something. So I thought, well, I'll give it to the National Library, where perhaps it should be anyhow. I did think of the National Gallery because of its connection with Glover, but I thought, No, it's a book, so I'll give it to the National Library. So that's my present idea.
It seems to me, as you speak, from your body language and your twisting and turning, that this subject of where you put the book is also something that's giving you pleasure to ponder upon.
Oh, yes, yes. Actually, I've, in my will, I've bequeathed the Australian Garden Collection to the University of Canberra, where I was the foundation librarian, actually, and where the Clough collection is, Richard Clough's collection of gardening books. And I catalogued the collection, and it's published as the Clough collection. And I thought, well, my gardening book collection, they teach landscape gardening at the university. It's a course, a degree course at the university. And I thought, well, perhaps my Australian gardening book should be at the University of Canberra. So that's where at the moment they're bequeathed at the moment. And I haven't told, or have I? I think I might have told them that I have bequeathed it to them. So that's the reason why I've been toying with what I do with my various book collections. I've got a number of different collections of Australian literature and Australian history and 18th century English history and so on. So, I've been working, toying with all sorts of ideas as to where I should deal with that, whether I should leave them or whether I should just put them out for auction.
I'll leave you to ponder that. but it makes me wonder, just before we do come to the Garden History Society, about whether were you aware of people like Richard Clough and his collecting at that same time, or were you in a vacuum collecting about garden history?
At the beginning I was in a vacuum. It wasn't until after I came to Canberra and after I met Richard Clough and met some people at the Garden History Society, that I began to realise, of course, that I wasn't in a vacuum. I just thought I was I was doing something that was rather eccentric, you might say, collecting these old Australian gardening books. And I know when I started doing my bibliography of Australian gardening books, I was doing some of it in the National Library because they've got a very good collection of gardening books. And someone at the National Library asked me what I was doing, and I said, I'm doing a bibliography of Australian gardening books. He said, what? What a crazy subject to be doing, you know. I said, well, I don't think it's crazy. I think they're a very important part of Australian publishing, Australian literature, and therefore, we should have a bibliography of them, and they should be studied. As I said, they were among the first books published in Australia. Almanacs were the first books that were usually published in the very early days in Australia. But gardening books followed very quickly on, and the first almanacs had a garden piece in them. The very first almanac that was published in Sydney had a section on gardening. And I said, because Australian gardening conditions were so different from England, they needed Australian information about gardening. And so they published things about gardening. The first gardening books were important. And he said, Oh yes, I suppose you're right, you know. So after his first reaction of, goodness me, why are you working on a silly subject like that? I didn't realise when I started, of course, all that it came as I studied them, actually.
Victor, were you doing this at the same time you were working as a librarian at the University of Canberra? Or did this work on your publications and your bibliography and your garden books happen in your retirement?
Oh, no. It happened while I was still working, actually. It started in Armidale, in Armidale, when I started collecting some Australian gardening books because I was restoring my garden in my little house in Armidale. And when I came to Canberra, I just continued. And when I found that the National Library had this collection of gardening books, I asked them if I could have... I started using them, and then I asked if I could have a desk in the Petherick Room, which they had very early on, for scholars that were dealing with particular research work in the library, and they said, oh yes, we'll give you a desk. And that was, that must have been right at the beginning of the 1970s, actually, because I came to Canberra in 1968. And so they gave me a desk in the Petherick Room then, and I was in a desk sitting next to the research assistant for our famous historian, Manning Clark, who was doing the research for Manning Clark's big history. And here was me sitting beside her doing my bibliography of Australian gardening books.